Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news, and we'll spend the hour in Background Brief of looking at the possibility of the United States going to war against Iran. We'll be speaking initially with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, the Air War College, and the Naval War College. He's been warning for some time now of a number of indicators which suggests that the United States is preparing for an attack on Iran. And then we'll speak with a former Iranian and now an American citizen, Abbas Hadim, who's originally from Najaf in the Shiite area of Iraq, where his family joined in the uprising against Saddam following the 1991 Gulf War at the urging of President Bush's father. Of course, the United States failed to back the Iraqis. They were hung out to dry. Abbas Hadim escaped to Saudi Arabia, where he was detained in a camp for over a year. Made his way to the United States. He's just finished his doctorate in Islamic studies at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's currently a visiting professor at Stanford University teaching Islamic studies. And we'll also hear from Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute. He served as the deputy director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department. That's the State Department's Intelligence Bureau. He was the chief of the INR's Maghreb, Arabian Peninsula, Iran, and Iraq division, and he was the State Department's representative to NATO, and he recently served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. So we'll get a very thorough look at the possibility of a United States attack on Iran try and sort of sort out the speculation from the facts as much as these things can be divined. I'm now speaking with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He has taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, the Air War College, and the Naval War College, and he's been warning for some time now and indicating some indicators that suggest the United States is preparing for an attack on Iran. And Colonel Gardner, what would be, to your mind, in response to the president's recent address to the nation on Iraq, there a number of people were alarmed, not the least of which were United States Senators Joe Biden, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee new chair, yeah, and Republican Senator also Chuck Hagel. He was quite combative with Condoleezza Rice, talking about using the analogy of what happened in Vietnam, where he served, where the United States invaded Cambodia and widened the war, making indicating that that's what he most feared. Yeah. And that's when he made that statement that this could be the greatest disaster in American foreign policy history, referring to, I think, this what we're speculating about here today. So give us your sense, first of all, 50-50, what do you think? 20-80? What's the percentages of?
Well, let me try. I think we're 50-50 as of today, but the Iranians are probably interpreting as a 90% chance we're going to strike, and that's because we're doing everything militarily that we would do if we were on the path to attack Iran in roughly March. There's a whole range of things. First of all, we are sending a second carrier battle group to the region. And
which president mentioned in his speech?
He did. And it is specifically going, according to both the pre-speech leaks as well as to the speech, because of Iran. That the Stennis, which is out of Bremerton, Washington, picked up its carrier air wing in San Diego yesterday and is now on the way to the Gulf. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and again this was announced in the speech, but we now have more details, that there is a Patriot missile battery from Fort Bliss, Texas, that's going to go to Kuwait. Now, there is nobody inside Iraq that has missiles. This is about the Iranian missile threat. We also know that the United States has plans to send minesweepers, and the UK is doing it also. And according to a British naval spokesman this last week, the minesweepers are there to deal with the threat that the Iranians may mine the Persian Gulf. The United States has deployed a squadron of F-16 fighter bombers to Incirlik, Turkey, the first time that that has been done in over 3 years. So if you're an Iranian and you're looking at these movements, we have to believe the United States is on a path to strike.
But of course, you also get leverage by threatening to pull the trigger without pulling the trigger. So give us a sense of what you think the game is here.
Well, it's that's true. I think, well, let me say it this way. I think the strategy that the White House has adopted, and they probably even say this in words like this, we need to put pressure on Iran in the full spectrum, meaning we've got to put diplomatic pressure, economic pressure, and military pressure. The problem with that is that we are also creating the conditions in the Gulf region where the kindling is there for a fire, even though you don't intend it. I mean, just for example, just yesterday, there was a report in the Kurdish press that the Iranians are massing troops, I don't know how many, but those were the words the press used, on the border in the northeast part of Iran, across from Iraq. Now, what's that about? You see, the situation, I have to say, I'm sort of a historian, and I get this sort of gut-tightening feeling that this feels like World War One, where neither side may have started out with intentions, and we've created the conditions that could start a greater Middle East war.
And, of course, the great historian Barbara Tuckerman referred to that period as the March of Folly.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we certainly could play into that, couldn't we?
Well, it is breathtaking when the president himself, who has never bothered to explain why he went to war in the first place, and he's changed his explanation a number of times. And of course, we all know that all the evidence that they proffered was exaggerated or perhaps lied about. So finally, he's come out of his cocoon, if you will, to explain to the public why he's having this surge. He recognizes the need. He went on 60 Minutes and then on the News Hour.
Right.
But
right.
Frankly, did you learn anything? I mean,
no, I don't think so. I let me just comment though. I'm sort of wondering, there's a thread hanging, which is about the Congress. And you mentioned Joe Biden. He said during the hearings. Now go back to Condoleezza Rice. Go back and tell the president that we have not authorized him to do anything with respect to Iran. He repeated that point. I tell you, frankly, my concern is that the Congress could find itself leveraged to the point that it might not be able to say no. Let me see if I can explain. Today, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli minister, who is not of Omar's party, but the other party, gave a speech, and it's a theme that he has been repeating, which is, we have a Holocaust coming. The Iranians want to eliminate Israel. In World War II, that wasn't stopped. The world has got to stop that right now. What's emerging is this argument that I think even the Democrats couldn't resist, which is, the reason we have to strike Iran is because it's a threat to Israel, and that's this is the new storyline that I sense emerging. And there's a very interesting connection in that storyline, which is it resonates with the religious right. There are religious right organizations in this country that are called Friends of Israel, and they say the same kind of thing. So if that echo begins to grow, even the Congress would probably find itself in a difficult position not to approve or agree to a strike on Iran.
Well, I must say, much of what Condoleezza Rice says is almost surreal. I'm always amazed at the kind of press that she gets. She's obviously been a total catastrophe as a national security advisor, and particularly in her culpability for 9/11, which, of course, they very skillfully, through the Republican propaganda machine, managed to try and lay most of that off on Clinton.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I'm just trying to find it here. Yeah, she said, I tend to place a lot of emphasis on the facts that people see their interest differently now from what they did 5 to 10 years ago. They see their interests less as continuing or having maximalist positions about this conflict and are more concerned about the broad strategic picture. She talks about Lebanon was a major contributor to the shift in alignment that makes the Middle East peace deal more promising, and that toppling Saddam Hussein, despite the current violence within Iraq, removed what she called an Eastern Front against the Israelis. So, I mean, if anybody believes that... they haven't been paying attention to the fact that there's a Sunni insurgency that's being ethnically cleansed from Baghdad, and that's moving west towards Israel. It's got no place to go.
Yeah, I think, let me sort of connect that with Iran. That my sense is that it isn't even the nuclear weapons they're worried about right now about Iran. It is about the growing Iranian influence in the whole region. And that's essentially what the Defense Secretary Gates said in his trip. But, I mean, clearly, if you know, Hezbollah, after the war now, is being rearmed, and there's a big chance that they could end up in control of the government in Lebanon. Hamas has been strengthened and is being strengthened by the Iranian money. And then there's what's going on inside Iraq. And... I think we're going to hear more of that as part of the justification, that this idea that it is the Iranians who are behind everything. In fact, there's a press report this morning from some Middle East press service that some additional Iranians have been arrested. So this whole thing is going to be growing about that the whole, here's the way I think they would phrase it. That we are losing our influence in the Middle East to Iran, and we have to do something to stop that.
Well, who's responsible for this, though?
Well, we are, clearly.
No, not we. President Bush, okay, Condoleezza Rice, and Vice President Cheney.
You're right. Or the U.S. policy is. But there's no... The problem we've got is... I sound like the president, but, where we are is where we are. The question that we're faced with is how do we not allow the Iranian influence to grow, and find a way to disengage from Iraq? And that's a very difficult problem. And I suspect that one of the ways that we can neutralize that would be that I'm convinced that it is possible to reach an agreement with the Iranians on a number of things. And if we were to do that, our status in the Middle East would change.
But don't you think, Colonel Gardner, that it frustrates me to read the paper and watch the pundits, that so much of what we talk about in foreign policy is delusional? For example, let's deal with the Afghanistan, the war that we're losing. If we haven't already lost the Iraq war, everybody acknowledges that we're in danger of losing in Afghanistan. It's so obvious that the Pakistanis are behind the Taliban. But only today did the New York Times do an in-depth piece on that.
Yeah, that was a wonderful piece.
Yeah, but it's been apparent for years. It's like in denial because we've got our good friend Musharraf there, and he's holding it together, and he's handing us the occasional al-Qaeda operative. So everything's hunky-dory. The same delusion in Iraq. We've got an Iraqi government. It wouldn't even exist but for the Green Zone and the protection of the United States military. These people will all be dead, but they're the government. We've got a military. It's so obvious that when every time Bush makes a snide remark about al-Maliki, they all laugh because they are clearly so much more loyal to the Iranians than they are to us. So do you ever feel like we're sleepwalking through this thing?
Well, we are, and you didn't add one to it that is high on my list, which is this whole notion with the Iranians about we won't talk unless they temporarily stop enrichment. I have a feeling that that's like a schoolboy argument. You can't cross your line. I'm going to cross my line. And then we're arguing over sort of trivial things. to whether or not we can discuss. So yeah, it is delusional, and you know, the problem, the reason that people get delusional is because the situation is so complex, I think. And that is, when it gets to that complexity, you end up searching for a way to simplify it, and the simplification ends up being disastrous. I remember a former CIA station chief in the Middle East told me once that the Middle East is like a mobile, you know, with all these parts hanging. And once you flick it, the whole thing goes in motion, and anybody who says they can predict where it's going to end up is kidding themselves.
Well, let's just get back to then the chances of us going to war. You've been talking about indicators.
Right.
What are the things that we should look for to divine President Bush's intentions? Because if they're going to be ready with this battle group in March, that's a possibility that they can do hot pursuit out of Iraq into Iran, going after the Al-Quds, the Jerusalem brigades, etc. And that's the Cambodian analogy. The other possibility, which seems more likely, is that towards the end of Bush's tenure, he and the Israelis are going to take out the nuclear facilities because he'll figure there's nobody else around that's got the cojones to do it, you know, and he's a lame duck at any rate. So run by those two scenarios and to look for.
Well, I think that, I mean, we know enough now from what good reporters have written that it is the second situation that is the one on the table, which is that the plan to go after the Iranian nuclear facilities with a 3 or 4 night raid with the objective of setting back the nuclear program 2 or 3 years, and more importantly, this is the important part, to punish the Iranians for everything they've done. And that is the one that I fear is close to being in place, because we have the forces now that are moving to the region to do that plan.
When would the trigger be pulled on that?
Well, I'll tell you when. I have one indicator that I was writing some things over the weekend. The Eisenhower carrier battle group is in the region. The Stennis carrier battle group is on the way. I received an email over the weekend to watch for the Nimitz being deployed, which is the third. If the Nimitz, we read that it's being deployed, I'm 100% certain that we have decided to execute the plan. You don't send 3 carrier battle groups to the Middle East as a threat, because that uses up your whole capability. So in my mind, that's the indicator. There will be some additional indicators. I expect that we will see some more missile defense batteries sent. I expect we would see one from Europe being sent to Israel, which we did during the Gulf II to protect Israel. And then we'll see additional tankers deployed, and we would probably see the new Air Force F-22 Raptors out of Langley in Virginia deploying to the region. So, we will know maybe a week or two before if we see these things beginning to unfold. And then this storyline that I mentioned, we know from a wonderful Boston Globe article that there is a group in the White House who has the mission to do media relations and convince the world, the words they use is to create outrage about Iran. So we'll see this storyline begin to accumulate also. So you will be enraged about Iran before you know it.
Been there, done that with Iraq, you know. And look where that got us.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us
you're welcome.
Here today, Colonel Gardner, and we'll stay in touch, because you've been on the pulse of this thing, I guess that we're leaving you with the two scenarios: either something's going to happen soon, or something big will happen towards the end of President Bush's tenure. But nobody's suggesting that nothing's going to happen. So.
No, but listen on Tuesday, we'll get an indicator.
I thank you again for joining us.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Colonel Sam Gardner, who's a retired Air Force colonel. He's taught strategy and military operations at the National War College, the Air War College, and the Naval War College, and he's been warning for some time now of a number of indicators which suggest the United States is preparing for an attack on Iran. I'm now speaking with Abbas Hadim, who's originally from Najaf in Iraq, the Shiite area of Iraq, where he and his family joined in the uprising against Saddam Hussein during the 1991 Gulf War at the urging of President Bush's father, and he was escaped into Saudi Arabia, where he was detained in a camp for over a year, and then he got to the United States, and he's recently finished his doctorate in Islamic studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and is currently a visiting professor at Stanford, where you're teaching Islamic studies at Stanford, right?
Hi, Ian. Yes, that's right.
And you're in touch with people back in Iraq, family and others. So if indeed, as some of the senators have warned us and have in their confrontation recently with Condoleezza Rice before her testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, so we know that people are concerned. There's the Cambodia analogy. So what's your feeling in terms of what's going on in the Shiite area of Iraq in terms of the presence of the al-Quds, the Revolutionary Guards people who the United States say are they're causing mischief and they are the targets for what the president said in his speech to destroy these networks. So tell me about the networks and what they're up to.
Well, first, it's good to hear from you. The Iranians are not the only ones who are interfering there. Pretty much everybody has set up a shop in there, the Saudis, the Jordanians, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Turks. But certainly the Iranians and the Syrians are more on the radar because of the nature of their relation with the United States. The reason why they are there, actually, one can mention two. One is the failure of the government in Iraq and the multinational forces to establish a working system in the country. And the second is basically because it's only natural to have relations because most of the people who are running the show in Iraq, at least nominally, have been in good relations with Iran, or they resided in Iran. Some of them were formed in Iran. So it is clear that one cannot disentangle Iraq from Iran, given the nature of the relations and the border they share together.
So what is the, it's pretty clear that push comes to shove, at least in my mind. I would think the al-Maliki government is probably more loyal to Iran than they are to the United States. And every time the president needles them, you get the impression that they don't, one, don't appreciate, and two, don't really care too much. Because, every time the president's told him to do something, like rein in Muqtada Sadr or, the guy that they just appointed to as their head of the so-called surge is clearly an officer from Saddam's navy who's completely ill-equipped. So I get the feeling that that al-Maliki is kind of giving us the finger here in a sense, you know.
Well, al-Maliki also, he is looking at his survival. He is, he owes Muqtada al-Sadr his job. We all know how that negotiation went after the elections. Also, the system that he is in does not give him much of the freedom to work, his cabinet in a favorable way. We have to sort of tune down our expectations of Maliki, because he certainly is not interested in splitting the Shia community or creating a civil war within the Shia community. This is a sort of a red line for most of the Shia groups. So it is very hard. Further, Maliki does not have really the grassroots support Muqtada has. Coming against Muqtada al-Sadr, I think it's a very dangerous proposition. It would be ill-advised for anyone to do it, because At worst, it will alienate the Shia community, and God help us if we have the other nine provinces join the insurgency. At best, it is going to create a similar situation to the one we had in 2004 and before it in 2003, when we were at the standing, at the cliff of a catastrophe. It is not going to be very helpful. So I think Maliki, if anything, he is, in a way, being the sane one here.
Well, let's look then at the who the insane ones are, and we of course continually refer to Saada and company as the bad actors. But it seems to be the pattern is pretty clear that it's actually the Sunni terrorists who continually instigate catastrophes and atrocities. And then the Shiites respond in kind. The latest example being blowing up those Shiite students at the university.
Correct. I mean, look, it's I think the reason we hear more about the Shia activities is because there is this giant media support for the Sunnis from the Arab world, and also the interference on their behalf by some of the strong governments in the region who have good relations with the United States. At best, when you hear about the Shia grievances, you hear about them from Iran, which nobody listens to anyway. So that's sort of already giving a head start for the Sunnis. But let's face the facts. I mean, more than 75% to 80% of U.S. casualties are occurring in Sunni areas and by Sunni insurgency. Also, the casualties among the Iraqis, if you look at it, it's out of proportion, the Shiites who are dying because of that insurgency. It is clearly something that we have to put in perspective, but we should not also or lose perspective of the problems posed by the militias, Shia or non-Shia, because this is going to be a problem for Iraqis in the long run. The reason why they are there and why they gain popularity in certain places and support, and they do have a lot of support, because they are the only ones who deliver to the Iraqis what the government has failed to deliver in the last 4 years. Muqtada Sadr is not just a militia or a troublemaker, that's for the U.S., but look at it for the Iraqis who are there. It's a big network of charities, of soup kitchens, of things that the government does not and cannot provide. And they are also, in many areas, the only hope or the only barrier between innocent locals and being slaughtered at the hands of vicious militias from the other side. So the support, I mean, Muqtada's popularity and Muqtada's phenomenon is really an indicator of the failure of the government and the multinational forces, to be quite frank, in achieving what they should achieve in the first place, security, and that's their job. 4 years later, it is a shame what is going on in Iraq.
And it's clear that we are perhaps trying to provoke the Shiite, at least the Saada's people, having arrested a lot. I think the guy that they arrested, actually, he'd become a criminal. And I think Saada has distanced himself from two of his former proteges. But what's going on there in the sense that you get the impression it's a very murky landscape between religion and criminality. But so try and sort this out, if you will.
Well, yeah, I mean, militias are, again, all the talk I gave about their popularity and how good they are for some people, they are not doing what they do for free or for the sake of charity. They are doing what they do for a price. And it's a heavy price in certain cases. But again, given the alternative, people will take the militias over any other alternative. And that is, again, how sad it has become in Iraq.
Well, what's our side saying when Abu Zaid, who is, by all measures is a very straight guy, and he speaks Arabic, and he's the guy that they just fired because he wouldn't go along with some of this surge business, and perhaps an attack on Iran. There's also speculation that he drew the line against that. He and others have continually said that the Revolutionary Guards, the Quds people, are in the Shiite area, and they're the ones that are providing triggering devices for IEDs, these infrared triggering devices. You just said that the Shiites aren't responsible for the deaths on the Americans, a very small percentage, most of which I think was when the Mahdi Army and the U.S. went at it a couple of years ago. So what's going on here? Who's telling the truth?
Well, if I recall correctly, Secretary Condoleezza Rice said we don't have evidence that the Iranians are, supplying any weapons for the Shias. I mean, I'm paraphrasing her. So there isn't real evidence that the Shias got supplies from the Iranians. But even if that's the case, I mean, just take a look where the U.S. casualties. It is impossible to think that the Shias would go to Fallujah to set IEDs or Anbar province or Diyala, that's not where the Shias operate. And certainly, like I said, Abu Zaid looked at the situation from a military perspective, and he's right. I mean, the last thing we want to do is to provoke a confrontation with Iran, or even to provoke a confrontation with the Shia community that has been handling itself comparatively very well in terms of the last 4 years. We should not take that for granted, or even try to exacerbate the situation to a point of provoking a confrontation. This Sadr movement itself is, I mean, they are smart, they are adapting. They just returned to the government and ended their boycott just in time when a confrontation was supposed to happen. And this surge, I don't care what everybody says about it. I think it can help if it is used in a sane way. But if it is used in the way they are proposing it, which looks to me like an engineered civil war, bringing the Kurds to fight the Shias and bringing the Shias or taking the Shias to fight the Sunnis, they are not mindful of the glitch that basically when the Shias see that their families and their buddies back home, they get hit by someone else, they will drop their arms and go back and join probably the Sadr militia. There is a lot of support also within the armed forces for Sadr. And I think, when the confrontation takes place, we will not have the Iraqi forces that we are counting on to lead the offensive in that if they see that they are being attacked, from the back by some Kurdish, troops that are ostensibly part of the Iraqi government or the Iraqi army. And that is going to be a problematic situation. I think the only solution, which is not being taken care of, is to credibly create and equip an Iraqi army and a good force to handle Iraq. And that is the only exit strategy that is available for the United States. But they are very sluggish in it. They do not trust the Iraqi government or the Iraqi armed forces, and they are not giving them any credible equipment or training, and that is going to make the mission for the United States very, very complicated.
Well, that, of course, is what...
have an air force. Iraq does not have really an army. I mean, In 2003, Iraqi army was one of the strongest in the region, and now they cannot hold a little town with 200 houses. I mean, it tells you where we are right now. How can you leave Iraq if that's the status of the Iraqi armed forces?
Well, this is also a complaint on Maliki levels, and did so recently, that the real issue is that the United States is not supporting and equipping the army. But let's just get back to this idea that the president mentioned, that they want to go after these networks. inside the Shiite area that are supposedly run by the Revolutionary Guards out of Iran, and that there's a fear on the part of senators like Hegel, who talked about the Cambodia analogy, that we'll go into hot pursuit against them into Iran, and that will be causus belli, and then we can unleash the bombs from the carriers, etc. So let's get start with the basic reality. Are there networks?
Well, clearly, I mean, the Iranians are there either by proxy or some of their own people. It's very hard. I mean, look, you know, Iran has many Arab nationals. A lot of them are Iraqis who are also in the Iranian forces. So you can find an Iraqi who speaks Arabic. He's an Iraqi in every sense, even by name and affiliation, and then they are working for. So how can you really tell who is who in that case? That's one. Second, you know, this is really sort of expanding the conflict into an unnecessarily. You know, we have already an enemy that is overtly against us, and that's the insurgency. I mean, to go after people who are not really actively against the United States in a way that is rising to the level of we have to go after them, the risks in it, it's really going to expand the geography and the demography of the conflict, and that's not in the United States' interest, at least at this time when we are gasping for enough troops in the three provinces where we have troubles. If we ignite another conflict in 5-6 other provinces, I mean, where are these networks working? Basra, Kut, Nasiriyah, these areas, and if we get them there, then we basically have to ask for a surge of more troops to handle those. It's not wise to conduct a war like that, and given the assets we have in Iraq at this point. And also, I mean, clearly, the Congress has made it clear that expanding the war towards Iran or Syria is not an option right now. I mean, the warning that was given by Senator Biden to Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Rice, in her testimony, he told her clearly, look, the current resolution does not authorize you to go after anybody inside Iran or, for any kind of pretext. And it is, it shows that people are reading some kind of writing on the wall that the administration wants to escalate and wants to mix two agendas in one. I think we should stick to the original agenda, which is finding a solution for Iraq rather than creating another problem by involving the Iranians or even some of the places in Iraq, the Shia areas, which are tolerable right now in comparison with what goes on in places like Diyala, Anbar, Baghdad. And that's the ball, and we should keep our eyes on it at this time, at least.
Well, just in closing then, Abbas Salim, what do you know about these Iranians that were captured in Erbil? There's some confusion over whether they're al-Quds or they're consular people. I mean, do you have any information on
that? Well, the story that comes from the Iraqi government says that they are people who are operating with the approval of the Iraqi government, and the Iranians claim that way, and the United States says that they are doing something that is objectionable. The fact that the Iraqi Minister of Foreign Affairs is intervening to release them, as far as I know, it tells you that the Iraqi government and the Iranian government are on one side and the United States on the other side, and that does not bode well for our effort there in Iraq. I think, again, the original sin of all of this is really the insistence of the administration to go against the advice of the Baker Hamilton that said engage the Iranians in a positive way, and they decided to engage the Iranians in a negative way. It's not wise to do that. I think the Baker Hamilton got it right. It's just a matter of overcoming the stubbornness of the policymakers in Washington.
So just in closing then, if there's a 50-50 chance of an attack on Iran, which is our previous guest, Colonel Sam Gardner, suggested there was, you don't believe that there is, in fact, the mechanism of provocation that the United States could find in the Shiite area that would be sufficient to create a smoking gun or to discover a smoking gun that would implicate Iran?
Well, they never needed a smoking gun to create any catastrophic situation the past 5-6 years. So I don't see, that would be sort of the only thing standing between them and doing it. I think the will is more important than the means and the smoking gun. But I hope to, and pray to God that it doesn't happen, because if we do something stupid and Iran retaliates in a painful way, I mean, my advice always when I meet with people who ask my advice in the administration or elsewhere, I say, if you are not ready to invade Iran, do not attack Iran in any way or provoke it. And from all the indicators I hear, from Congress and all the people involved, that we don't have the means or the readiness to invade Iran at this point. Iran is 5 times the size of Iraq and 10 times the fanaticism that you can find in the Sunni triangle. And I think we should really, again, heed the advice of Baker Hamilton rather than do another neocon kind of adventure that the United States cannot afford to suffer to suffer its consequences.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Abbas Kadim, and we'll continue here. We'll actually have a guest on next who was a part of the Iraq study group. So I thank
pleasure
you for joining.
Pleasure is mine, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Marcel. Just speaking with Abbas Kadim, who's originally from Najaf, Iraq, the Shiite area of Iraq. He and his family joined in the uprising against Saddam following the 1991 Gulf War at the urging of President Bush Sr., and he escaped into Saudi Arabia. He was detained for over a year. He came to the United States. He's just finished his doctorate in Islamic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He is currently a visiting professor at Stanford University, where he teaches Islamic studies. I'm now speaking with Wayne White. He's a scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute. He served as the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. The Bureau of INR, of course, is the State Department's intelligence wing. He was the chief of INR's Maghreb, Arabian Peninsula, Iran and Iraq division, and the State Department's representative to the NATO Middle East Working Groups from 1990 to 2002. He recently served as an advisor on the Iraq Study Group. And Wayne White, you've been quoted here quite recently in a flurry of stories on the internet about that you've seen plans or know of plans to attack an array of targets in Iran, creating a path for a larger targeting, taking out much of the Iranian Air Force, Kilo submarines, anti-ship missiles, etc., that would target commerce or U.S. warships in the Gulf, and maybe even Iran's ballistic missile capability. But I think they're actually misquoting you to the extent that this is nothing new, right?
That's something that basically was leaked out of the government and became something that we learned, several people learned, back in late winter last year. So in that sense, no, it isn't. It isn't new, but those plans are still on the table as far as everyone knows, and every time the president is asked about it or an administration representative is asked about it, it's basically, well, that those options are still there. So, yeah, it's not a new story. It's at least 10 months old, but those plans are sitting there and probably still being cobbled and worked and adjusted and what have you.
But the plans themselves came out of a briefing that the military gave to President Bush to essentially tell him what an attack on Iran really would involve.
Yeah, that was the impression that some of us had. That, basically, the president seized personally, with the potential so-called existential threat that an Iranian nuclear weapons capability would pose to Israel, was rather determined to move in the direction of an attack to take that out, take out Iran's nuclear capability. And the military was very, very concerned that the president did not appreciate how complicated all this was, how difficult the target array was, how difficult it would be to get through to the target, and what you'd have to do to achieve that, which is basically taking out much of Iran's air defense system and its air force, and then you have to assume that, of course, Iran's going to retaliate, as anyone would in those circumstances, and then you take down as much as you can of Iran's retaliatory capability in the Persian Gulf, which consists of, as you said, surface-to-surface anti-ship missiles, especially near the Strait of Hormuz, can target our fleet, can target tankers, what have you, and also her submarines. Probably, even though I'm not certain that this was mentioned specifically, a large portion of her speedboat fleet, Revolutionary Guard speedboat fleet, which is geared to sort of overwhelming and swarming against otherwise, hard to approach vessels and attack them. That's a tall order, and one concern that a lot of us have, and probably the military planners as well, is that to do this, we're talking about, and a figure that I heard was 1,500 aerial sorties, long and short range, and cruise missile sorties, attacks, spanning a period of days. Now, during those days, the Iranians may not wait for all that stuff to be destroyed. They may start striking back in the Gulf even before that's over. So we're talking about, you know, a massive attack, which would surely be interpreted as by Iranians as a virtual war with the United States, and one which, if, again, this should ever happen, would have the Iranians trying everything they can to retaliate, and shorn of their options in the Gulf, would probably do some nasty things in Iraq, which would present itself as an inviting target where American forces are strung out, throughout the country. Just short-term impact, for one thing, would be to send the world price of oil skyrocketing, which none of us would particularly be interested in seeing. I mean, to in colossal heights of, possibly $100, $120, $150 a barrel.
But what are the indicators there that if the president got this briefing, and presumably it was a sobering briefing about what it, militarily it would require, our first guest, Colonel Sam Gardner, said that the Eisenhower group's already there, the Stennis group's on its way, having just picked up its air wing off San Diego yesterday, and it'll be there in a couple of weeks. And then he thought that you'd have to, in order to bring about the full plan, you'd have to bring in the Nimitz group as well. So I guess, armchair strategists can look at this and see whether the assets are being put into play.
Yeah, I think that's true, and the activity that's going on now, I don't think is something that one can interpret as pre-attack deployments, although that may creep up gradually. I think at the present time, and judging from the rhetoric that was even in the surge speech, and we're likely to hear in the State of the Union, that pressure is being placed on Iran. The arrest that you discussed with your previous guest inside of Iraq. Things like this are meant to pressure Iran to back off in the context mainly of Iraq. If a huge strike against Iran, rolling strike that, was described in contingency planning earlier this year, last year, came about, that would be in reaction to the nuclear issue, not in reaction to the Iraqi front. And one problem a lot of us have to confront with respect to what Iran does in Iraq is exactly what you were discussing with your previous guest. What Iran does in Iraq is almost entirely covert. And so it's very hard to, without an access to the intelligence stream I used to have in the government, to know exactly how much Iran is doing and exactly what Iran is doing. An explanation that the Iraqi government gives doesn't hold much water with me about the activity being benign, because up in the Kurdish area, the Talibani Kurds, Jalal Talibani, currently being president of Iraq, is also the head of the Popular Union of Kurdistan, which has had a traditionally close relationship with Iran, even calling Iranian troops into Iraq, into their areas, to fight rival Kurds in 1996, so an assurance from that quarter wouldn't be terribly assuring to me. And the Iraqi government, being headed by Prime Minister Maliki, with ties to Shia militias, with ties to Iran, would not be particularly assuring to me either. And so it is somewhat of a muddle, exactly what the Iranians are doing along the border and inside of Iran, right now.
But Wayne White, do you think that that again, you know, that we're being suckered? And I sometimes think much of our discussions about these things are delusional in the sense that we don't talk about real stuff. We don't, for example, talk about how much Musharraf and company are backing the Taliban. It's only come out in the New York Times today comprehensively, but the writing's been on the wall for the longest time. So there are certain things we just don't talk about. We talk about an Iraqi government. It wouldn't be a government but for its protection inside the Green Zone. We talk about a military, Iraqi military, that's dubious and largely Shiite and Kurds, and they don't even want to join in the military. So they've been dragooned into this surge thing. So I get the feeling that the Maliki people are much more loyal to Iran than they are to us.
Well, it was. I don't know whether they're more loyal to Iran than us. They're probably, to some degree, loyal to themselves and their own interests inside of Iraq. And right now, very heavily driven by anti-Sunni Arab, sentiments. In fact, the fact that Muqtada al-Sadr seems to be, improving his behavior right now by reentering the government, et cetera, merely means that he doesn't want to tangle with U.S. troops like he did 2 years ago. You mentioned that most heavily in Najaf. And I think, frankly, he's just planning to wait us out. The president was trying to sell the surge as a rather short-term measure. Well, that's the way it's probably being read by Shia militias that have been cleaning out Sunni Arab neighborhoods in Baghdad, as something short-term to be waited out. And there'll be a lot of statements about how much progress has been made because Baghdad will be more quiet while the surge is going on, et cetera, only to have 5, 6, 7 months down the line, if we don't keep our troops there, the same kind of death squad and Sunni Arab retaliatory cycle just resume.
But why would we want, I mean, the choice seemed to be, from what you're saying, Wayne White, is they're obviously pragmatic. They're keeping their power dry. We're beating up their enemies at any rate, the Sunni, so they don't have a motive to really tangle with us. But if we tangle with them, then we're really taking on a nightmare, right?
Absolutely. If the United States decided that it was on to what the Mahdi militia and Sadr were doing, which is most likely waiting things out and trying to look political and not military right now, and went into Sadr City, that huge, sprawling area with well over, I think, 1.5 million inhabitants, it would be another Fallujah battle. It would be horrific.
Well, Bob Baer says it's worse than southern Beirut.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's larger. I've seen it. I've driven through it. And in fact, one advantage some of us have is that we saw a lot of Iraq before the war, when you could walk around, when you had the freedom of movement that even correspondents and others, well protected, don't now. And I can tell you, Sadr City is sprawling. It would make a hell of a difficult place to have to go into. But you see, the surge, therefore, if it doesn't go in there, won't really achieve its mission. And if you want to basically eliminate the death squads, if you want to stop the cycle of violence permanently, you take down Sadr, you crush his militia, and put an end to that. This is the way a military mind would think. And we are not going to do that. We're going to use the Iraqi army to sort through Baghdad and protect mixed areas and what have you, and be sort of a backup force. And if Sadr's quiet, we'll leave him alone. I don't want to take Sadr on, because you will create a second insurgency, a Shia insurgency, which also objects to occupation, just not as intensely as Sunni Arabs, because they have the majority and therefore an interest in following through with the democratic process. But they also object to the occupation. If you go punch them in the face, they're going to punch back. And so I don't know whether I'm making sense here, but it's basically, if you go in and surge and militarily confront the people behind death squad activities, and most of the death squad activities in the Baghdad area emanate from Sadr City, you're going to have a hell of a battle, and you're going to create tens of thousands, if not millions, of new enemies. If you don't do it, when you leave, it's going to start all over again. And so it's essentially catch-22.
Well, then, just in closing, Wayne White, what's going on here in terms of the bellicosity from the administration and the speculation that we're engaging in here today about an attack on Iran? Anything that they do in terms of going after the networks in Iraq, if indeed they are networks, seems to be just sort of futile and petulant, and attacking Iran itself seems futile and petulant. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we have to look to see whether the president on his way out decides it's time to take care of Iran and he's not going to allow them to get a nuclear weapon because nobody following him will have the guts to do it.
Well, that's something we have to watch and wait to see the final answer with respect to whether the nuclear issue is going to propel the United States into another major campaign in the Middle East. I don't think it would involve boots on the ground. It would involve these massive airstrikes. But there are certain things that some people just have to keep in mind. And one is, once you start that, even if you don't have boots on the ground in that rugged country I flew over only a week ago, seeing whiteout conditions in the mountains of northwestern and western central Iran, how do you end it? Once you start something like that, the Iranians are not going to run up a white flag at the end of the airstrikes. They're going to look for a way to punch back. And it could go on forever. In fact, when Saddam lashed out at the Iranians in the fall of 1980, at the beginning of what we call the Iran-Iraq War, Saddam actually deluded himself into thinking that he would really hit the Iranians hard and rock them back on their heels and prevent them from thinking of toying with Iraqi politics and sending people across the border again. And instead, Saddam ended up in an 8-year slugging match with the Iranians, and we want to avoid that kind of thing.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Wayne White.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just beginning with Wayne White. He used to be the Deputy Director of the INR, the State Department's Intelligence Bureau. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kurt, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer, and also thanks to Elliot Fong. This program is available at ianmasters.org.